by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got really a very fine guest this evening, Frank Gregory Ford, and he has quite an experienced background in the military, and he has quite a story to tell us. So welcome to our program, Frank Gregory Ford.
Thank you, George. It's good to be on your show. This is the very first time, too, with your show.
Yeah, yes, it is, and so, welcome to our program. We've done a lot of different kinds of stories and individuals and so forth over the years, and we've done some military people out of Vietnam, but not anyone this recent out of Iraq and so forth. So could you sort of tell our listening audience a little bit of your background, and then we'll start explaining your story to our listening audience?
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure, George. Okay, well, I'm out in California right now, and of course, you know, like all Californians, we don't do anything unless it's right by the ocean or right by the pool. So if you don't mind, George, and your listeners don't mind, I'm going to broadcast from the side of my swimming pool, okay?
Okay, off your mic a little bit, if you could, just from your phone there, yeah.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah,
okay.
That's better, yeah. Okay, so you're out there relaxing around the pool. That's a good that's a good way to start a program, isn't it?
Yes, well, we have these forest fires out here, and it's actually made the whole day look kind of foggy and brown, so I said, okay, well, hey, you know, I can just do your show, and that'd be great.
So you started in the military, and you had quite a few years in the military. Tell us how you got started in the military.
Okay, all right. Let me see. I started way back in the dream time. A few of your listeners might remember President Nixon, Richard Milhouse Nixon. And I joined the Coast Guard. That was my first service. And that was my first job was security, presidential security for President Nixon at the Western White House. So I was there for approximately 2 years. And we were actually, we were with him when he resigned. Okay. He was the first and only president to resign. And we were with him when he resigned at that time. And so all of a sudden they had a whole group of people that were highly trained, didn't have anywhere to go. So they gave us all assignments all over the world. And so they sent me to school. Okay. And that's where I started my medical career. In New London, Connecticut, and at the Coast Guard Academy, and then from there I went to the Caribbean, actually Miami, Florida, and was doing medical evacuations and drug enforcement, flying all over. This is before Miami Vice and so forth, and so we chased drug smugglers all over the Caribbean, and then from there, I actually left the service, left active duty, and got an education, and then I joined the Navy, and I worked with groups, very interesting groups like the Navy SEALs. They used to be UDT, underwater demolition back then, and then Marine Force Recon, young man commando stuff, George. And then I joined, after a certain age, you know, you need to get away from that stuff. And so I joined, military intelligence with the Army. And that was about 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And I have been with military intelligence right up to Iraq. And I specialized in electronic intelligence intercept, which you're familiar with, George.
Right.
And then I became an intelligence analyst, analyzing intelligence as it's coming in from all sources. And then I became a James Bond kind of guy, a counterintelligence expert and running different spy nets and so forth. So I've had assignments all over the world. You name it, I've been there. And so anyway, my last assignment, in which turned out to be the most amazing assignment of all, was Iraq. And so anyway, I was in Iraq, and I'd actually put my letter of retirement in, and so I did not expect to have what happened. Okay, I was with the group that was at, we were headquartered at Abu Ghraib prison, and the infamous Abu Ghraib prison, and my commander was the infamous Colonel Thomas Pappas, P-A-P-P-A-S. Okay, and the reason why I give you his name is because right now I have a federal lawsuit, okay, with a Ninth Circuit court, and he is one of the defendants. In fact, all the defendants that were at Abu Ghraib prison that I was working for are defendants in my federal case. And of course I filed the charges. I filed the first charges to try to stop the torture and abuse that was going on by my own group, by the way. And I was the medic and doctor who was taking care of the victims of torture and abuse. So the way I left Iraq was something that has never happened to any intelligence agent, you know, at least in America that I know of. Okay. When I filed the charges, I was actually threatened. Okay. Imagine them threatening me, but I was threatened, and then I refused to back down. Because they were committing war crimes and I wasn't about to let them get away with it. I was physically grabbed and thrown onto a stretcher, strapped to a stretcher, and shot full of what are called CIA drugs, okay, interrogation drugs, aka, torture drugs, alright? And after being subjected to those torture drugs, I know what torture is now, alright? And so anyway, I was Actually, according to the declaration of my commanding general, Janis Karpinski, I was flown out of Iraq covertly on a plane, on a transport, basically unconscious, and I was flown without orders. Nobody knew I was even missing from Iraq, except for my lawyer, and then I was flown through this was highly illegal. I was flown through German airspace while I was drugged and being tortured, okay? Which is a major incident, even as we speak, as I'm saying this is a major incident with one of our allies, okay? They want to know right now how that incident happened, okay, and how it happened to me. So, anyway, I landed in Germany, and I was able to contact my lawyers in America, and needless to say, they got on the dime very quickly, and I think that's probably the only reason I'm talking to you today, George, is because of my lawyers immediately contacted the commander-in-chief, they contacted the White House, they contacted the Pentagon, and they said, I better not arrive in a body bag. I was alive and breathing when they spoke to me last, so I better not be the victim of a friendly gunfire incident. So anyway, and then of course once I got back, the Abu Ghraib disaster broke, and everybody knows what that is. You know, the 60 Minutes Abu Ghraib show.
Yeah, there's quite an abusive of the prisoners there by the jailmates, by the guards. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And there's much more to it than that. Those photos that the public has seen and your listeners have seen, there were only 5 photos shown. Okay, there was actually close to 500 photos taken of the torture and abuse. And I mean, it was so violent, you know, and so disgusting and nauseous that, most Americans cannot be shown the photos of what their children were doing to the Iraqis. It's that bad. There was 4 hours of streaming video, and I actually witnessed the House Armed the House Committee on Intelligence Collection being run by, being chaired by Senator Feinstein after they viewed that footage, and they literally came out of their green. I mean, they looked absolutely like they were about ready to pass out and faint. Okay, so that's how gruesome, you know, the torture was in Iraq, that we were doing it, that we were entirely responsible. And I know because I was busy trying to repair the damage, okay, to these Iraqis. So, and most of them were, you know, about 15 years of age and kids, and we shouldn't have been doing what we did to them. All right. So anyway, to make a long story short, that's how I got to, you know, speak on your show today.
Right. You know, Samara figures prominently in this whole story that you have, is it not? And what was there? Was it an intelligence operation for Saddam Hussein or what?
Well, Samara is,
yeah, Samara,
is where I was operating. Okay,
right,
that was our area of operation. We were the only intelligence unit operating in that area.
Okay.
And we were, myself and my team, we were in a old burned out police station. Right, there's a bridge that crosses over the Tigris River and goes into Samara. Samara is known in the Bible as the Golden City. When you're driving to Samara from a distance, you look up and there was a spectacular golden mosque and a blue minaret. Okay, just spectacular. And you could see it from miles and miles away. And unfortunately, that golden mosque, the Askaniya Mosque, no longer exists. All right, it was blown up by Al-Qaeda, and that's what started the war, virtually the civil war in Iraq. Okay, was Al-Qaeda, who was living and working right next door to our police station. All right, I had gone over and spoke to them, and sent the reports, and strangely enough, nothing happened, George. I don't know what's going on, but as I said on my shows, and you've heard my shows.
Right.
Something is going on with a group that we armed, we organized, we trained, we logistics, we transported, we intelligenced, we guided, okay? We stamped the visas of Al-Qaeda, okay? Al-Qaeda is our organization. Right. And I sent several reports in saying Al-Qaeda is here in Iraq, in Samara, all right? What are they doing here? Are you folks going to come and get them? All right. Never got a response from my command. And of course, the main reason why they were in Samara was Samara is the old gold transfer or banking city. Okay. That's why they call it, one reason why they call it the Golden City was that's where all gold was brought into, for banking purposes. And, you know, Islamic banks are a little different than our banks. And so I was given documentation from one of the bankers showing that Al-Qaeda was there receiving gold transfers, gold shipments from Saudi Arabia. All right. Gold shipments. Okay. Were coming in on trucks ostensibly for carrying, they were carrying, humanitarian goods. So I thought there was something really strange when I made all these reports about Al-Qaeda right next door. And fortunately, we had a bit of a working relationship with them because I was a medic, okay? So they had medical questions. But we both knew who they were. And my banker, you know, who was working for me, my Iraqi banker said, look, these guys are extremely dangerous. You need to know who they are. Here's their banking records. Understand this. So needless to say, for some reason, the command let those Al-Qaeda exist right there in the old hospital right next to the police station there in Samarra.
Well, you know, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So anyway, every day there was a new drama, okay? It was never a boring place in Samarra. Samarra, like I said, was the old ancient capital of Mesopotamia, all right? And like I say, you can pick up the Bible anytime, George, and see all kinds of references to Samarra. You know, the road to Samarra in dealing with death, you know, death was always talking the highway to Samarra, the road to Samarra, okay? And so it goes back to ancient times. The graveyard, which we were actually surrounded by in Samarra, in the police station, the graveyard is close to 5,000 years old, okay? So it has a long, long established history there. But I was there, and this is what relates to what's going on last night on the show, on the Clyde Lewis show, was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was looking for a reason to turn in and get some rest. Since we had taken to grabbing kids off the street and torturing them, and killing them, throwing them off the bridge, you know, letting them drown in the Tigris River, we were under attack virtually every night. Probably 5-6 times a night we had rockets and missile attacks. And so anyway, right about 3, things started to slow down, and all of a sudden, here comes my source, okay? And my source, and that's intelligence speak for spy, all right? And my source showed up and said, look, I need you to do something for me. And okay, what's that? And he said, I've got two people I absolutely need you to recruit, all right? You need to get control of these people because they are too well connected, and they're way too sharp. They're way too tough to have running around without any kind of control. Now that Saddam Hussein is out of power, we need to have these people in Samarra controlled, very specifically. One was the banker, okay, the very famous Hussein's banker, who had been his head of counterintelligence, Abu Sajer. Okay, and you can type that name in and see what happens at George. Abu Sajer, and who I promptly recruited, and he was promptly taken from me and beaten to death by the CIA, because he was the banker who handled all financial transactions between Iraqi banks and American banks and the Carlyle Group. And I didn't mispronounce that. I believe that's how they say that in Texas. The Carlyle Group.
Yeah, the Carlyle Group. That's the Bush Group, yeah.
Yes, right. And then the Carlyle Group, who was busy shipping weapons of mass destruction. Hopefully that came through loud and clear on the show.
Right, right, it did.
Weapons of mass destruction, all right. The P-400 converted bomb casings. 1,000-pound bomb casings used to drop VX gas on the Kurds and the Iranians were that was the product of American manufacturing and American sales. All right, and it was the Bush family who was responsible. Okay, if you look up the record of who voted for development of nerve gas agents. It was George H.W. Bush, who I think Texas is busy trying to reform his past history and reputation, rehabilitating. And secondly, it was George W. Bush, all right, the person who sent me to Iraq in the first place. And we actually found it was 29 warheads I found 29 warheads in the bunker with another agent, and we got the numbers off of those weapons, and we expected those weapons to be reported to the weapons inspectors, and they never were, and they were destroyed promptly the next day by British intelligence, technical intelligence. So anyway, that was Abu Sager, okay? And I recruited him, and he gave me a massive amount of intelligence on the relationship between the U.S., especially the Bush of regime, both regimes, and Saddam Hussein. And he showed me the pictures of Dick Cheney shaking the hand of Saddam Hussein, securing a deal for weapons of mass destruction purchase and to be used on the Kurds, and then Donald Rumsfeld shaking the hand of Saddam Hussein, securing a deal for more nerve gas agents to be dropped on the heads of the Iranians. You know, now everybody's so outraged that the Iranians might actually develop nuclear weapons. Well, given the fact that how many Iranians have been killed and murdered by U.S. weapons of mass destruction, I find that a little bit ironic. All right. So,
yes, it is. There's one point I wanted to make here. And were you over there when L. Paul Bremer took over as head?
Of course. Oh, sure.
Okay,
let
me make a point here because it'll play right into what you said about the Al-Qaeda being left alone. Remember, he disbanded the Iraqi army. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
When he did that, then it opened up for Al-Qaeda to come in, which they were supporting, and then they waged civil war. That created a civil war because they wanted a bunch of chaos there, didn't they? You think?
Well, you know, nothing could have ushered in chaos into a situation that was fairly stable. You know, the first 3 months we were there, things were fairly stable.
Right.
Okay. In fact, it was like, you know, kind of the attitude, general attitude was like, hey, we're all dressed up and no party to go to.
Yeah, give me a time scale on this. What date would that first 3 months cover that you were there? What dates here?
Oh, gosh. What was that? About, you know, around the 1st of April, okay, April, May, and then things really started to heat up.
2003 you were talking about here now? 2003?
Yes, 2003. Right.
2003, April or May, right in there. The first 3 months that y'all arrived, it was pretty stable and pretty peaceful, right?
And it was like, you know, everybody was saying, well, like, gosh, hey, there's nothing to do here. Everything's kind of calmed down. And next thing you know, Paul Bremer dissolves the army. Okay.
Right.
I mean, you've got highly trained, you know, people, you know, and especially people that are paid. Okay. All of a sudden, overnight, they're out of a job and they're not being paid. Okay. And so what kind of animosity that could cultivate, it was to be seen. Okay. I mean, that could have done nothing but generate bad will, and it did immediately.
So they immediately became terrorists, jihadist terrorists, with Al Qaeda as their base. Is that what happened?
Pretty close. You know, one of the things that Americans that haven't been there is first of all, the Iraqis were not a bunch of wild-eyed crazies leaping around like you see on CNN. You know, like they just can't wait to kill somebody or kill themselves. No, it's not like that. They are a well-educated society. Most of them are multilingual, okay, and they had a fairly well-organized army that had Russian consultation on its structure. They had French equipment. A lot of the Iraqi pilots were trained in France. I mean, it was a fairly effective organization. And they were tough. You know, the Iraqis were tough. They'd been fighting a war with Iran for 10 years, you know, which was over not too long before we got there. And plus, they had been dealing with one of the most brutal dictators, you know, history's ever known, you know, right behind Stalin. And Hussein admired Stalin greatly. And in fact, his intelligence services, which I'll get to in a moment, those were all organized along the Russian GRU military intelligence lines and the KGB intelligence lines. So those folks knew what they were doing, and along we come and tell them, oh, guess what? You're no longer employed. You know, we're running this show in your country. And overnight, you know, there was instant hostility, but that wasn't the big problem, George. The big problem was they were armed about four times better than we were. All right. Virtually every village I went into had a huge warehouse full of small munitions, medium-sized munitions, and sometimes large munitions. I mentioned last night, I found nuclear detonators, they're also known as pits, in one of the largest munitions depots I've ever seen. There was at least 300 bunkers over at least 500 acres, okay, that I saw. It was called the Alakaka facility, and that facility ended up providing most of the high speed, high explosives that were used to destroy our armor, our vehicles on the road. Those are known as IEDs, by the way. And that's where most of those munitions came from. So those folks, were completely armed to the teeth before we got there, and they weren't afraid to use those weapons, and they knew how to use those weapons because they'd been in a war, for the last 10 years, okay? So plus they knew the whole area. We didn't hardly know anything about Iraq, okay? You know, several of my maps were old National Geographic maps from the 40s, okay? So, we hardly had any information on Iraq. And those folks knew it backwards and forwards, which is a critical aspect of intelligence. So Paul Bremer comes along, fires everybody. You've got all these people that were used to having, good pay and being part of a trained organization, a disciplined organization, all of a sudden wandering the streets. And of course they're going to blame the people that were responsible, and that was us. So yes, Paul Bremer, who never had to fight anybody a day in his life, okay, proceeds to issue something that was so monumentally stupid it was almost beyond description. And then of course the poor U.S. soldier was left there to fight the situation and deal with the situation. So anyway, I was sitting in the police station one night, George, and 3 o'clock in the morning, here comes my source. And he said, absolutely recruit, Abu Sager, of course, and these other two people. Do not let these other two people get away. One was Abdullah Talabani, and the name, you might recognize the name as being the he went on to become the future president of Kurdistan. And the other one was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And I'm sure all your listeners know that name now. Okay. If they've been awake, paying attention to the news in the last few weeks.
Yes, sir.
They know that name. Okay. And so I immediately requested permission to recruit. I could never get permission to recruit. Okay. Al-Baghdadi. Okay. And it turned out that Al-Baghdadi was the head of Samara Mukhabarat. Now, Mukhabarat was the greatly feared, and justifiably so, the intelligence organization of Saddam Hussein. The Mukhabarat kept Hussein in power, and their sister group was Mukhabarat Syria. Okay? So, you've got an intelligence organization being run by a fellow in Samara that knows everybody, knows their address, and working with their counterpart in Syria who knows everybody and knows their address of where they can be found. All right. And knows exactly how the American forces work and do things and operate. And so you've got virtually unlimited financing coming from Prince Bandar, okay, in Saudi Arabia, being funneled through Saudi intelligence into this group now, and you've got this group that realizes that there is a tremendous power vacuum that has been left by the withdrawal of the Americans. So you know, these folks knew what they were doing. They knew where everybody was located. They knew how to raise and organize an extremely lethal, dangerous group of people, and that is exactly what they've done. You know, look, George, looking at the photos last night as I was talking to Clyde on his show, you know, I was looking at the photos of the ISIS group, and they're all in brand new trucks, brand new vehicles,
right,
brand new weapons,
exactly,
brand new clothes. Yeah, what is going on? You know, their trucks, their vehicles are about 10 years newer than my Humvee that I had, okay, in Iraq. My Humvee that I had in Iraq was barely running, okay? I mean, it barely functioned.
Gosh.
You know, so here's these people. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, so ISIS is there and it's been funded by the Saudis and other individuals and controlled by the CIA and so forth. And their goal is what, to take over some of those resources there, the oil and so forth, and then expand into Syria. They're already in Syria, but is it to provoke the Syrian government so that we can start attacking or put a no-fly zone over Syria? Is that the next play out of this or what?
Okay. ISIS owns 40%. They almost own 50% of Syria. They run it, control it, okay, and they own at least 60% or more of Iraq, okay? And as I said last night, they didn't just take a bunch of empty desert, you know, to take over and control. No, they chose exactly the most productive oil-producing sites in Iraq, all right? Now, I keep saying this, and it keeps falling on deaf ears. I don't know what the problem is, George. Iraq has more oil, what is called sweet oil, okay? You know, a dirty oil that has a high sulfur content, and you Texas folks can appreciate this.
Right.
Okay. You have to refine dirty oil, and it takes an enormous amount of energy and time to make it usable. But sweet oil, you know, you can basically just distill it down and refine it down into its basic constituent products and, you know, what you need. Diesel, a JP4, you know, gasoline, you know, even road tar. Okay. You can break it down immediately.
Right.
Well, one of the things that our media doesn't tell the American people is that there's almost five super modern refineries in Iraq. And they have on an average of 14 pipelines moving between themselves and the loading port in Kuwait. All right, in Kuwait, Kuwait City, actually, to be exact. Okay, now Iraq has more oil than all the other Middle East countries combined. Okay, everybody says, well, Saudi Arabia, this, Saudi Arabia, that. No, the oil reserves in Iraq dwarf the Saudi reserves. All right, I know this because one of my sources was an Egyptian lawyer who translated for Halliburton, and he translated English into Arabic into English in a legal format, and he informed me of exactly who has what in Iraq, and also informed me about the issue of torture, you know, why we were torturing, and it had nothing to do with getting information, okay? It was pretty diabolical why we were torturing people. So he informed me, he said, no, he said, this is what you're after, and I thought, oh, okay, great, well, of course we're after oil, okay? He said, no, that wasn't the point. The point is to make sure that oil is kept off the market and used only in a controlled fashion so I won't threaten the Saudi oil supply of OPEC, all right? Because what would happen if all of a sudden this unlimited sweet oil hits the market? okay, the price of OPEC oil falls through the floor.
Yes, exactly. Good point.
Right. Okay, and so guess what happens now? You've got a group, okay, that nobody seems to know anything about, but the group seems to have all the intelligence in the world that it needs. It knows exactly what it's doing, and it is unlimited in its financing. And guess what? It swept in with, quote, 1,500 people, swept in, what, 2 weeks ago? 3 weeks ago, maybe? Swept through. I mean, met virtually no resistance. And now I'm hearing that now they have 35,000 fighters in ISIS. Okay, that's a hell of a recruitment drive, you know. I mean, what is that? You know, 15,000 people a week is what they're recruiting. And so, like I said, this doesn't happen all by itself. You know, the logistics of an operation like this are tremendous. So those folks have support, they have the intelligence, and they have an unlimited source of fighters coming in that are trained. You know, a guy carrying a gun is pretty worthless. But when you have trained, highly trained seasoned fighters, like some of the fighters that they're bringing in from Syria, okay, that's what Syria was for ISIS, was a training ground, a training facility, all right? And so when they went in and they were dealing with a bunch of lazy Shia, you know, cowardly Shia, you know, who were used to, you know, total corruption, which they were used to in Iraq, I mean, there was no standing up to a highly effective force. So that's what I see, and that's the way I see it, is that the fellow that I could have controlled, we could have brought into, you know, our stable, which we probably did in the long run, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, okay, is actually using his Mukhabarat resources, unlimited resources, and he is now directing this whole operation. And if you don't think so, here's something for your listeners, Don, is that he wants to start the second Khalifa or the third Khalifa, something like that. Well, the Khalifa, okay, actually the second Khalifa was killed in Samarra by Genghis Khan, all right? And that's when they started the Shia and the Sunni, the Shia and the Sunni, schism, the separation, you know, of Islam. When that happened, when the second Khalifa was killed. But he was killed actually in the Garden of Allah, you know, at the base of the spiral minaret. Okay. You can still see the spiral minaret there, in Samarra. But in the Garden of Allah is where he was killed by Genghis Khan. So that should tell you, they're tentatively using, you know, the tenets of Islam and a little bit of history to justify a very modern takeover of some of the wealthiest, richest oil area in the whole world. Period. The whole world. And the irony is, if you look, you know, like there are some pictures of ISIS executing people, banging on doors and taking people out in front of the camera, shooting them, you know, cutting people's heads off. Well, if you notice, they're not cutting or shooting anybody in the head that is an oil engineer, an oil technician, a refinery worker. They're not killing them, okay? No, they're killing all those corrupt Shia bureaucrats, okay, that they already had all the intelligence on and knew where they lived, okay? That's what they're doing. That's what makes them so effective. And as I said last night, I think you would agree, George, and your listeners will agree, they're here to stay. They're not going to have they're not about to have a bunch of expensive hardware, you know, that flies off an aircraft carrier deck, tell them that they got to leave. No, they're there to stay. And the only way to disrupt a group like this, which we're not going to do because our ally is supporting them, Saudi Arabia, is the only way to break up an insurgency is to stop their funding, which is not going to happen, and stop the intelligence. And they have better intelligence on the ground there than we do. So Al-Qaeda is there to stay. and ISIS is there definitely to stay. All right. So, so, you know, so this whole, this, all this eyewash and hand wringing and weak sister carrying on about, you know, doing something about ISIS, we're not going to do anything. All right. That, and that's why they're a product of our own machinations. Okay. Our own Machiavelli carrying on. Okay. In the Middle East, we are responsible for ISIS. Nobody else. We are responsible. They, you know, yeah, they, if we hadn't done what we've done in Iraq and made a hash out of things, excuse me, as badly as we did, ISIS would never have gotten a foothold in. Okay.
Yeah,
but
one of the indications was that when they showed video, there'd be two or three vehicles out on the road and a bomb would go off. We'd, you know, bomb them. You know, I mean, you know, two or three vehicles. See? Well, we could have bombed some of their storage depots or something, but we didn't. So that's, you know, backs up exactly what you're saying. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So we're gonna do nominal attacks on so-called ISIS and make it look like we're really trying to control them, right? Is that sort of the way it's going to play out, you think?
It's just a bunch of eyewash. It's a bunch of knee-jerk politics going on.
Yeah.
I mean, Obama's ratings have never been lower. You know, Iraq was directly responsible for George Bush and his record approval ratings, which were in the cellar for most of his presidency. So, it's not rocket science, okay? Those folks know what they're doing, and we've got as I said last night, I mean, look at 9/11. Good example, okay? Where did the 19 hijackers get their visa stamped? Okay, they enter this country to produce 9/11 on the American people. Where did they get their visa stamped? If you didn't hear that part, I'll tell you, George. Okay, and I'll tell your listeners.
Yeah,
they got them stamped in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Right. All right? Right, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Now, where in Jeddah? They got them stamped at the CIA. CIA station in Jeddah, all right? And I spoke at length to the fellow who said, do not stamp these visas, and he was summarily fired by the now director of the CIA, all right? So that's what kind of relationship we have with the Saudis and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, there was information that came out that the head of the desk in Berlin before 9/11, he said in an interview from a newspaper article that they were monitoring Mohammed Atta there in Hamburg, but they had no hard evidence that he was going to do anything, see. But they were marshaling and organizing all of those people to bring them in here to initiate the 9/11 operation. That's what I see.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mohammed Atta, okay.
Yeah.
Did you hear I don't know if you heard last night when I talked about Anthony Schaefer, Colonel Schaefer?
I know of him, yeah. I know him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and the date's important, okay. If I'm running over with this stuff, George, let me know.
Okay. No, we've got about 15 minutes to go. We've got 15 minutes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In July, and I want everybody to make note, you know, make note of this date, July of 2000, okay? July of 2000, I was at one of my interminable intelligence training courses, and this was here in the States, and it's probably the largest intelligence training area, you know, in the world, all right, for multinationals, you know, train there. And let's see, how did this happen? Okay, now we're sitting there, and it was the end of the course, and we were all kind of wrapping things up. And in walks the head of the course, okay, a distinguished gentleman. He's no longer alive now, and he's passed on. And so he walks in and he says, all right, everybody shut up and sit down. And he was serious, okay. I mean, we're all adults, and normally you don't talk to adults unless there's something very serious going on. And so he said, okay, I have something and Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer has something to say to you, and came down like this. Okay, we had a we in briefings, and you can appreciate this, you have the S2 and the intelligence part of a briefing, and you have the S3, the operational part of a briefing.
Yes.
And Colonel Shaker actually said, he told us about the first part of something called, okay, it wasn't called 9/11. It was something that his group, Able Danger, okay,
yes,
was pursuing. Able Danger. And by the way, in my opinion, Colonel Shaker is probably one of the bravest, souls that this country has ever produced. And what was done to him after 9/11 is a war crime in itself. All right. He should be running for president. We should have somebody like that, you know, not some lame bull like George W. Bush.
Charlotte Littlefield and I went up in 2010, and we have him in the All Souls Church talking about all this 9/11 stuff on video.
Shaper, really?
Wonderful,
okay,
guy. He's right there with us. He's quite a patriot.
Okay, he is the guy. And he said, okay. He said, everybody here, go home, get your lives in order, get your affairs in order. We are tracking and tracing the communications of two groups of terrorist operatives, and the number about 20 altogether. And we are tracking them, and they are going to do something. Okay. We know they are going to hijack planes, and this is within the next 18 months. They're going to hijack planes. They are going to fly those planes into the World Trade Center. They are going to take, other planes, and they are going, and these are the exact words, hit select targets around the Washington, D.C. area. Select targets, all right? And he said, I want everybody here to go home and understand that you will be chasing Al-Qaeda operatives within the next 18 months, because this is going to happen. They are going to do it. We know, we've been tracking them for several months now. I actually sound like a couple of years, but several months. And so go home, get your affairs in order, and be prepared, because Osama bin Laden has never, ever said something where he didn't mean it. All right? He's never made a statement where he didn't follow through. And he means it, and this group is here in the States. And they are going to do this, all right? And, of course, you know, somebody raised their hand. Everybody was pretty aghast, because usually in the intelligence business, it's maybe, sort of, or possibly, okay? But there's never a definite. Very seldom is there ever a definite, this is going to happen. And this was a definite. And somebody raised their hand and said, well, look, is the FBI informed of this? Because, you know, we can't operate. American intelligence agents cannot operate on American soil, because there used to be, until George Bush, there used to be laws protecting the American people from the intelligence community, and rightfully so. Now, we don't want another third world banana republic disaster, so there are laws, something, you know, which the Bush administration was never familiar with, something called laws protecting American people. And if you don't think so, all your listeners can go to my federal lawsuit that I have filed with the Ninth Circuit Court and see what I think about the laws protecting people. All right? They can see that. It was filed 2 days ago. They can go read my opening brief if they think I'm not serious about that. And so anyway, we are informed the FBI knew everything that Able Danger knew. Okay? And Able Danger knew a lot about what was going to happen, as it turned out to be 9/11. All right? So they were informed, and the agency was informed. Surprise. The agency stamped their visas in Jeddah, okay, so they could get in and do 9/11. And like I said, the fellow that I spoke to, who absolutely refused to stamp their visas, but he was overridden. He was overridden by the now president, the now director of the CIA, John Brennan. Okay, the fellow I talked to was fired by John Brennan when he refused to stamp those visas. And John Brennan ordered those visas stamped. They came in, and they gave us 9/11. And, of course, the way the bureaucracies work is you screw up, you move up. And, of course, they made John Brennan the director now of the CIA. So that's how the whole disaster of 9/11 came about. And of course, the subsequent investigation, who stood in the way of the investigation more than anybody on earth? It was George W. Bush. All right, George W. Bush was responsible for doing everything he could to keep the largest terrorist attack in U.S. history, and the largest number of people, even more than Pearl Harbor, killed, and it was George Bush who did everything he could to stop that investigation.
Right.
So, anyway.
If it wasn't for the Jersey sisters or ladies, there wouldn't have even been an investigation into 9/11. And then they whitewashed it and structured it and left out a lot of information. And like William Rodriguez, the janitor, they didn't call him in there. Or they, I think they called him in, but it never went into the record or something. But they poo-pooed a lot of good intelligence there about what went on that day. The energy that it took to bring the North and South Tower down, though, took an extraordinary technology, see? And that's still being investigated by some of the top, you know what I mean, architects, engineers, and physicists in the country. See, it took a tremendous new technology, we think, to do the North and South Tower, because they were built so strongly, the Building 1 and 2.
Well, something your listeners don't know, okay, yeah. I'll tell you, listeners. And I want to thank him for listening to me talk for an hour. And I appreciate you having me on, George, greatly.
I appreciate you being with us this evening.
Well, it's this. Within 48 hours after 9/11 struck, 48 hours, Anthony Schaefer, Colonel Schaefer, and his entire Able Danger team had every shred of their intelligence shredded. Destroyed, all right, by the Bush White House Inspector General. They came in and seized every bit of intelligence, okay? Now, keep in mind, you know, we were given the briefing on 9/11. It turned out to be 9/11, okay? And it was exact, okay, exactly what happened. And those clowns actually it was the Pentagon, okay, the Pentagon Inspector General, and who I take real exception with because it was headed up by somebody named Joe Schmitz, the infamous Joe Schmitz. And he basically came in and, like I say, ordered every piece of intelligence evidence destroyed that Able Danger had accumulated. And he also They ordered the investigation of Colonel Schaefer, and they proceeded to attack his character in an unrelenting, vicious, it wasn't just disturbing to watch. It was enraging to watch, okay, watch them attack that man, okay. The man who really should be president, Colonel Schaefer should be president. He should run for president, okay. Some joker like George W. Bush sat by and allowed that to happen and allowed his attack dog, Joe Schmitz, to cover up any evidence that we did know and we were trying to stop 9/11. Okay, that is one of the great travesties of all time. So yes, that did happen. That's confirmable. And as far as my case goes, and as I said last night, Able Danger, I want your listeners to look up Able Danger, and if it doesn't enrage them about what happened, okay, I don't think too much will, but in my case, in terms of what goes on with my case, I would like everybody to look up Copper Green. Like I say, don't take my word for it, you know, just go out and do their own investigation. Copper Green, all right? That is why we had the biggest war crime scandal in U.S. history was Copper Green, the name Copper Green. So, you know, I want to get that out there. And if you don't think that these are important, you know, these operations, go look at my court case. Okay, right. That's up before the Ninth
Circuit
Court.
We've got about 4 minutes left now. How about your concluding remarks? Any other details? And you'd like to make some concluding remarks Frank Gregory Ford?
Okay, well, like I said, George, and like I said, I'm greatly pleased to be on your show, and I'm grateful to the folks in Texas. They have been supportive. Texas was one of the first places when I was strapped to that stretcher, shot full of torture drugs, and I actually arrived, I arrived in Germany, and in Germany they said, oh my God, you've just been brought through German airspace. Now, and you were tortured in German airspace. This is an international incident, and it's actually an act of war against the German people. So we've got to get you out of here. And they sent me to Texas, okay, San Antonio, Texas. And I was treated very, very well in Texas. And the Texans are nobody's fools, okay? I told them what happened in Iraq, and they said, we are going to investigate, and they did. Thank goodness there's, the Texans are as sharp as they are, and they said, no, there's something going on here, and this sounds like something terrible, and it's an embarrassment that it didn't happen. And they actually, the folks in San Antonio actually ordered the investigation into my case and what had happened, okay, at Abu Ghraib prison. Okay, it was those folks there. So I'm greatly appreciative of the folks in Texas as being as sharp as they are, and being as courageous as they are. So, it was a pleasure, broadcasting to your folks, your listeners in Texas, George.
Well, we certainly do appreciate you being with us. And you gave such insights also about Paul Bremer and so forth, and the disbanding of the army. And that was purposely done so that they could open up this civil war and they destroyed Iraq during that period, didn't they? Huh?
Oh, yeah,
and we went in there and tortured people. We helped destroy the thing. It was just terrible what happened. And I certainly appreciate you coming on the show this evening and giving us insights that only someone, that first person that was there on the scene, could testify to. And we certainly wish you good luck on your court cases. Is there any website or anything that you can tell our listening audience to go to?
Well, I do have a Facebook site, and I was just informed about 2 hours ago, George, that I am going to have a new website because, like yourselves and your listeners, when I say things, people want to go and check them out. And so I'm going to have a website, very shortly. Okay. It's being put together today. Okay.
Do you know the name yet, or is it?
I don't know the name, but hopefully, George, you'll invite me back to your show.
Oh, you're certainly right. I'll invite you back. You stand up with Schaefer and those people. I stand up with you and them too. You bet. You bet we'll do that. And you can
direct
people to your Facebook, and you can always put it up there too. So we want to thank you this evening very much for being with us, Frank Gregory Ford, and thank you. You're really a brave American, and you're a true patriot. So thank you very, very much, and good night.
Okay, and thank you and your listeners also.
Okay, good night.
Good night, George.
Bye-bye.